The headlines: China slams its groundless allegations by the U.S. and its allies that Beijing was behind a massive hack of key Microsoft servers. Blast rocked the Afghan capital Kabul as several rockets land near the presidential palace during Eid al-Adha prayers. And Peru's new president Pedro Castillo calls for national unity after winning a lengthy battle over the results of the June 6 polls. Thanks for joining us. China has denied Western allegations of carrying out a massive hack of key Microsoft servers. Chinese embassies in Australia and New Zealand issued fiery statements. They described the allegations as groundless, irresponsible, and a malicious smear. They accused Australia of parroting U.S. rhetoric. They described Washington as the world champion of malicious cyber attacks. On Monday, the U.S. and its allies, including New Zealand and Australia, publicly accused China of hacking Microsoft Exchange. That is an email platform used by corporations around the world. They also accused China of a global espionage campaign. Political commentator Timothy Kurzweil says the U.S. has provided no evidence to back its claim that China sought to hack Microsoft servers.
Well, before reaching a conclusion like that, I'd love to see some evidence that China is responsible. All we've seen from the statement of the United States and its partners is these allegations, but no evidence whatsoever of any connection to China or the Chinese government. I mean, it's a fairly standard playbook from the U.S. government. We saw this in May with the SolarWinds issue with the Russian government. The United States accused Russia of the same type of cyber attack, again, providing no evidence to support its claims. So it seems like whenever the United States wants to stir up a sort of trouble against one of its rivals, this is a fairly easy play to run, where you sort of rely on your authority and get some support from some international partners to make these allegations, but don't really back them up with anything. And that's enough to sway people's opinion a little bit.
Blast have rocked the Afghan capital Kabul after several rockets landed near the presidential palace during Eid al-Adha prayers.
Sami'allahu liman hamida. Allahu akbar. Allahu akbar. Allahu akbar.
The interior ministry said at least three projectiles were fired at the palace. The ministry blamed the attack on the enemies of Afghanistan, saying that it caused no injuries. Despite the attack, President Ashraf Ghani and others continued with the prayers, marking the start of the Eid al-Adha Muslim holiday. Soon after the attack, the president addressed the nation. The incident comes as Taliban militants are pressing ahead with a sweeping offensive across the country. Earlier we talked to our correspondent in Kabul, Amin Alami. He told us that the Afghan president, Ghani, blasted supporters of terrorist groups that carry out such attacks.
The Afghan president, Ashraf Ghani, also blamed the supporters of the terrorist groups in Afghanistan for launching such attacks and said that, and directly pointed out to this rocket attack and said that those who are behind this rocket attack want to show that the people of Afghanistan will face a very intense fighting and a very dire situation in case they ignore to approve the demands of the supporters of terrorism. Instead, President Ghani stressed that the nation of Afghanistan will strongly stand alongside the Afghan National Security Forces in order to protect and defend their own country. However, the Afghan President Mohammad Ashraf Ghani also directly blamed Pakistan for backing terrorism in Afghanistan and spreading war and violence. He once again called on Islamabad to stop interfering in internal affairs of Afghanistan under backing terrorism and supporting the terrorist groups inside this country.
More than a dozen diplomatic missions in Afghanistan have called for an urgent end to the Taliban's military offensive. In a statement, the missions said the offensive was at odds with claims that the Taliban want to secure a political deal to end the conflict. The statement was signed by the U.S., the European Union, and some other foreign missions. That follows another round of inconclusive peace talks over the weekend in Qatar between representatives of the Afghan government and the Taliban. Two sides said on Sunday that they'd agreed to meet again next week. They have been meeting on and off in Qatar for months, but have achieved little. This as the Taliban make battlefield gains under a series of offensives, first launched in early May. Political commentator Tim Anderson says the current state of affairs in Afghanistan is due to the collapse of the 20 years of U.S.-led occupation of the country.
Well, it's mainly what we would expect of the collapse of a 20-year occupation, an illegal and criminal occupation, let's remember, with most of the members of that occupation now calling themselves wrongly the international community or the global community. It's a collapse of a puppet regime set up by NATO and led by the US, and it was really to be expected. If anything, it reminds me of the collapse of the puppet regime in South Vietnam back in 1975. Now, apparently, Erdogan's Turkey, which is a member of NATO, of course, is pretending to manage a transition of some sort while they supposedly maintain control of Kabul airport. But really, this just reminds me again of Erdogan setting up a Syrian national army, and he's now seems like he's threatening to set up an Afghan national army too. It's bizarre, and it's an intervention by NATO in this region which has never had any basis in international norms, international law.
Pakistan has urged the Afghan government to reconsider its decision to recall its ambassador and other senior diplomats, which followed kidnapping and the releasing of the daughter of the Afghan diplomat in Islamabad. Both countries have agreed to undertake a joint investigation into the incident to hunt down the culprits. Shavit Rana has more from Islamabad.
Bilateral ties between Pakistan and a beleaguered government in Kabul have witnessed another low after Kabul recalled its ambassador and other senior diplomats from Islamabad, citing security concerns. It happened after the daughter of Afghan envoy to Islamabad was briefly kidnapped and released. The incident, according to police, happened during her back-and-forth movements on several cabs she herself hired for her travel between Islamabad and nearby city of Rawalpindi. The diplomatic row has preceded extraordinary territorial gains by Taliban, who now claim to have taken over 85% of Afghan territory following the exit of almost all US-led NATO troops from Afghanistan. Kabul has blamed Islamabad to have done little to contain the movements of Afghan Talibans from its nearly 2,700-kilometer-long porous border.
Networks and organizations supporting the Taliban are openly celebrating the destruction of the assets and capabilities of the Afghan people and state. Also, we call on Pakistan to use its influence and leverage for peace and cessation of hostilities.
Islamabad has repeatedly accused President Ashraf Ghani's government and India together to have provided sanctuaries in Afghanistan to anti-Pakistan terrorists who killed tens of thousands of people in this part of the world over the years.
No country has tried harder to get Taliban on the dialogue table than Pakistan. We have made every effort, short of taking military action against Taliban and Pakistan, we have made every effort to get them on the dialogue table and to have a peaceful settlement there. To blame Pakistan for what is going on in Afghanistan, I feel, is extremely unfair. Why would they listen to us when they are sensing victory?
Pakistani officials say that Taliban listen to them, but they do not control them. And over the years, Islamabad has lost significant influence on them. However, Kabul is not willing to accept this argument, given the ongoing military campaign by the Taliban, recapturing districts after districts with little resistance from the security forces in neighboring Afghanistan. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Moving on, Peru's president-elect Pedro Castillo has called for national unity in his first speech after an elections jury proclaimed him the winner of the June election.
عدة this moment, I call for the broadest unity of the Peruvian people. I call for unity to forge and open the door to the next bicentennial of independence, sealing this bicentennial with all its differences, with all its problems.
Castillo said that he would work toward economic stability. He also asked his right-wing rival Keiko Fujimori to avoid putting barriers on the country's way forward. Electoral authorities rejected Fujimori's fraud accusations after reviewing them. The jury validated the vote count, which gave Castillo over 50% of the ballots cast, some 44,000 more than his rival. The new president is due to be sworn in on July 28th. Meanwhile, the jury's declaration also leaves Fujimori facing an imminent corruption trial. Prosecutors have said that they would seek a 30-year jail term for Fujimori. Wall Street has witnessed its biggest plunge in months amid fears of a protracted economic recovery in light of a surge in COVID cases related to the Delta variant. All three major U.S. stock indices ended the session sharply lower, with the S&P and the NASDAQ suffering their biggest one-day drop since mid-May. The Dow Jones Industrial Average also plummeted over 2%, as investors were worried about the coronavirus and its impact on global growth. This also as governments in many countries implemented fresh restrictions to counter the Delta variant. European shares also sank over 2% on their worst session in 9 months. The resurgence of COVID infections and its impact on global economic recovery is believed to be behind the fall in European shares. Professor of Political Economy Jack Rasmus earlier joined us with a breakdown of the causes that led to the slump in U.S. markets.
There's other factors, too. The growth rate in reopening the economy here in the U.S., which was quite robust earlier in the spring, April, May, now is showing signs clearly of slowing down. And I believe we run the risk here in the U.S. of what happened last year. We opened the economy. We gave a little bit of fiscal push, not as much as they said, but some. And then it dissipated. And by the end of the third quarter, it pretty much ended. And in the fourth quarter, the economy in the U.S. almost came to a halt. Well, we're running the risk of another relapse. What we got is a rebound because the economy is mostly opened. But we could have a relapse again in the fourth quarter, especially since it looks like, once again, we're repeating the fiscal stimulus is not sufficient and it will dissipate by the end of the third quarter, I believe.
Muslims around the world are celebrating the Eid al-Adha holiday, or the Feast of Sacrifice. The occasion marks the conclusion of the annual Hajj pilgrimage. Prayers have taken place in different countries, including Syria, Bangladesh, Indonesia, and Afghanistan. Muslims in Palestine held their prayers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound under limitations imposed by Israel. Like last year, Muslims have marked the Eid al-Adha while observing social distancing rules because of the pandemic. As part of the celebrations, they visit friends and relatives. Some also have sacrificed animals like camels and sheep and donate their meat as charity. The practice aims to honor Prophet Abraham for his willingness to sacrifice his son as an act of obedience to God's command. Yemen Scholars Association has held a symposium in the capital Sana'a to condemn Saudi Arabia for banning millions of Muslims from the Hajj pilgrimage. Abdul Latif Al-Washali has more.
On the day of Arafat, Yemen Scholars Association held a symposium on the Great Mosque of Sana'a. The symposium entitled Preventing Hajj is a Deterrent from the Grand Mosque and a Service to the Nation's Enemies denounced the Saudi regime's ban on foreigners from Hajj. A large number of Yemeni scholars attended the event.
This move serves the Zionist interests. There is a great conspiracy against Muslims. The Saudi regime has deviated from the path of Islam. All Muslims must get united to protect their sanctities against the Zionist plots.
The Scholars Association issued a statement accusing the Saudi regime of serving the Zionist agenda by targeting Muslims' rights. The statement also condemned the silence of the Islamic nations toward the Saudi practices against Islam.
The decision to ban millions of Muslims from Hajj pilgrimage is in line with the colonial projects. The colonial powers seek to change the nature of Islamic sites. We condemn and deplore the silence of the Islamic countries around the world towards a deliberate targeting of Islamic sanctities. We call on all Muslims to condemn what the Saudi regime is doing.
For the second year, Saudi Arabia prevented millions of Muslims from holding Hajj pilgrimage, saying this step comes amid the precautions against the COVID-19 pandemic, whilst thousands of people attend music concerts in Riyadh and Jeddah without any restrictions.
Yemenis believe that the Saudi regime is deliberately targeting the rights of Muslims, including the Hajj, as part of implementing the Israeli agenda in the region. They say Saudi Arabia has no right to ban millions of Muslims from their right to access holy Mecca. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Adelaide becomes the latest Australian city to impose a lockdown as the country is struggling to contain a rapidly spreading outbreak of the COVID Delta variant. The seven-day lockdown begins in Adelaide on Tuesday. It affects more than 14 million Australians, restricting their movements to only essential activities. The lockdown also shutters non-essential businesses. Australia has been fighting its outbreak of the Delta variant for a month now. The virus has created around 100 new cases a day. The most populous state, New South Wales, accounts for most of the cases. Some major cities, like Melbourne, have extended their curbs or plan to do so. So far, Australia has vaccinated only 11% of its population. And that is for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
Dear listeners, we're going to continue discussing Imam Khomeini's testament. As a reminder, we said that Imam Khomeini strongly believed that religion is intermingled with government and that Islam can properly cope with the requirements of time. He did his best to expose those hands which were trying to show Islam as inefficient to administer society. Please stay with us. founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, used to say that the enemies are hell-bent on portraying the Islamic Republic as incompetent in tackling social problems. He wrote in his testament, "Of these kinds of plots, and maybe more wicked, are the widespread rumors in the country and provinces saying that the Islamic Republic has done nothing for the people. Poor people have sacrificed enthusiastically to get rid of the rebellious, oppressive regime. Yet, they have been beleaguered by a worse regime. The arrogant have become more arrogant, and the oppressed have become more oppressed. The prisons are full of young people who are the hope of the country's future, and tortures are worse and more inhumane than the former regime. Every day, some people are executed in the name of Islam. One wishes that the name of Islam was not put on this republic. This era is worse than the era of Reza Khan and his son. People are plunged in suffering, trouble, and skyrocketing inflation, while the ringleaders are directing this regime towards a communist regime. People's properties are seized and freedom has been prohibited for the nation in everything, and many other such-like affairs that are being put into effect with a scheme." The founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, believed that lack of information on the situation of other countries and the fate of other revolutions has caused the plots of enemies to be effective in deceiving some people in Iran. He wrote in his testament, "The basis of the issue is that many of them who hear these things and believe them are unaware of the situation in other parts of the world, the revolutions, the post-revolution events, and its great inevitable hardships. I recommend to them not to embark on finding faults, vitriolic criticism and insulting before studying the current situation of the world and comparison of Iran's Islamic revolution with other revolutions, and before familiarity with the situation of the countries and nations to see what would happen to them during their revolution and after their revolution, and before heeding the hardships of this country that has been under the rebellious rule of Reza Khan, and worse than that, Mohammad Reza, who have bequeathed to this government during their pillage, and before examining the performance of the government and the Jihad Construction Organization in deprived villages and comparing it with the former regime, along with considering the hardships of the imposed war and its consequences, such as million-strong homeless, families of martyrs, the war-stricken, million-strong Afghan and Iraqi refugees, and with regards to the economic siege and continuous conspiracies of the United States and the external affiliates. Isn't it better to try to reform and help instead of repressing?" Imam Khomeini continued in his testament by saying, "I have never said and don't say that today, in the Islamic Republic of Iran, the great Islam is being implemented with all its dimensions. And some persons do not do against the rules of Islam out of ignorance, grudge, and lack of discipline. I rather say that the legislature, the judiciary, and the executive branches of government are making strenuous efforts to Islamize the country, and the 10 million strong nation is also their supporter and helper. And if this fault-finding and obstructionist minority rush to help, these ideals would materialize easier and faster. And if the Almighty God forbid, they do not come to their senses, as the million-strong masses have woken up and pay attention to the issues and are present in the scene, the humane Islamic ideals will spectacularly be put into effect, God willing. And the stray and the fault-finding will not be able to resist against this raging flood." We'll be right back. Another excerpt from Imam Khomeini's last will and testament reads, I firmly claim that the Iranian nation and its million-strong masses are better off than the nation of Hejaz in the time of the Messenger of God. Blessings of God upon him and his progeny, and the people of Kufa in Iraq in the time of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, and Hussein ibn Ali, blessings and greetings of God upon them. The Hejaz were in the time of the Messenger of God, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, even Muslims would not obey him, and would not go to the front with pretext so that Almighty God reprimanded them and promised punishment for them in ayahs of the Surah Toba in the Holy Quran. And the people of Iraq, the people of Kufa, who misbehaved the commander of the faithful and disobeyed him to the extent that his complaints are famous in the books of narration and history. And those Muslims in Iraq in the city of Kufa who caused what happened to the master of martyrs, Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, and those who didn't submerge their hand in his martyrdom either fled the battlefield or sat so that the crime of history occurred. But today we can see that the Iranian nation, from the military, law enforcement, IRGC and Basij volunteer forces to popular forces of volunteers and the forces in the fronts and the people in the back of fronts, embark on such sacrifices and epics. And we can see what valuable aids the respectable people across the country have granted. And we can see that the survivors of martyrs and the war-stricken and their relatives face us and you with epical visages and enthusiastic and assuring words and deeds. And all of these stem from their full love, attachment and faith in Almighty God, their faith in Islam, and perpetual life. This is while they are neither in the blessed presence of the noble prophet, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, nor are they in presence of the infallible imam, blessings of God upon him. Their motive is their faith and trust in the unseen. But this is the mystery of success and victory in different dimensions. Founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, calls on young people who have been deceived by enemies and hypocrites to think fairly and freely. He says in his testament and will, I recommend that young people, both girls and boys who have been exploited by hypocrites and opportunistic and profiteering deviants, to judge impartially and free thought the propaganda of those who want the Islamic Republic to be destroyed, and the quality of their practice and their behavior with deprived masses, and also their morals, and their behavior among themselves and their advocates, and their change of stances in various events, and carefully and without mean desire, examine and study the state of those who were martyred in the Islamic Republic by hypocrites and deviants, and evaluate between them and their enemies to see which group is the advocate of the deprived and oppressed in society. Well, dear listeners, next time we will continue with other parts of Imam Khomeini's testament. Until our next program, goodbye and God bless.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to The Spotlight. Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei, on the occasion of the Hajj pilgrimage, has called on Muslims to resist aggression and interference of Western powers. particular, he referred to the U.S. interference in the affairs of Muslim countries in the West Asia region. And in this edition of The Spotlight, we will analyze Iran's leader's statements with our guests, review which countries he believes there is aggression by the West, and see how this interference can actually be dealt with.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has issued a message on the occasion of the annual Hajj pilgrimage. The event is underway in Saudi Arabia with only 60,000 pilgrims. The number is far below for one of the world's largest annual religious gatherings, which saw some 2.5 million attending the ceremony before the coronavirus pandemic in 2019. In his message, Ayatollah Khamenei said Muslim nations have mostly been subject to aggressive Western countries' greed and interference over the past 150 years. The leader said Muslims should now make up for the past and stand firm against the aggression and wickedness of Western powers. He noted that the straight path shown to Muslims by the Hajj is to rely on God and to show firm determination when moving forward and to have abundant hope for victory. Ayatollah Khamenei said the followers of Islam enjoy a large population, vast lands and countless natural resources and must use their assets and resources to build the future. The leader said resistance against the United States and other transgressing countries will help Muslims take their fate in their own hands. He urged Muslims to rush to the assistance of their fellows in Palestine, Yemen, Syria, Iraq, and other countries where the U.S. and its cohorts have been interfering for years. Ayatollah Khamenei, however, pointed out that the emergence of the resistance forces in these countries has been a blow to the aggressors. The leader said resistance fighters are eloquently expressing their firm decision to confront every act of interference and malice on the part of the U.S. and its cohorts. Ayatollah Khamenei warned that the U.S. seeks to distort the will, demands, and actions of resistance forces in the region. He stressed that such efforts stem from America's deep ignorance about awake and alert regional nations. The leader noted that such ignorance led America to be humiliated in Afghanistan 20 years after its Raqqa's invasion of the country. He called on Muslims to keep up their struggle as God has truly promised to assist those fighting in his way. Ayatollah Khamenei concluded that the primary result of the struggle in the way of God will be to prevent America and other international aggressors from interfering in the affairs of Islamic countries.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Debate, we have director at the Risalat Strategic Studies Institute, Sam Mahdi Torabi, who joins us. Also, Kevin Barrett joins us. He's an author and Middle East expert who joins us from Madison. I'd like to welcome you both. Sam Mahdi Torabi, let me first start with you. When you take a look at the statements made by the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, basically saying all Muslims need to resist the West's aggression and wickedness. Now, how should these countries and Muslims resist the West's aggression, as Iran's leader has stated?
Well, we have to remember that he also mentioned the history, which is a history that, if you look back, what basically happened is that when the British, primarily, but also the French and others, but primarily the British, when they established a global empire, they came to the conclusion that in order to control this global empire, they need to control the place in the world where Europe, Asia, and Africa meet, which is what we call West Asia or the Middle East, or as the Pentagon calls it, CENTCOM. And so from that time on, there was an effort to control this region. Well, first what they did is they did it through old school classical colonialism and imperialism, which is they came in and they ruled it directly. But then later, when the Americans inherited the British Empire after World War II, this was not as easy to accomplish. And so what you had to do is you had to come and you had to take over the ruling elites and the governments of those countries, which, of course, Iran at that time was a prime example during the rule of the Pahlavis. And so basically what resistance means is that the peoples, the people who live in this region, which is West Asia, which is the heart of the Islamic Ummah, have to take control of their own destiny by taking control of the governments that rule them, as opposed to having countries, as we see, for example, Saudi Arabia and others, where the elites and the ruling class have absolutely nothing to do with the people. It's very interesting. Those countries that are popular, have popular systems of government, like in Iran, are those countries that immediately decide that they want to have an independent strategic existence and want to be independent strategic actors in the world and have their own and take their own destiny into their own hands. And those countries where the governments are completely vassals of the West and whose rule, the rule of those governments, is not in any way, shape, or form dependent on the support of their local people, those are the governments that do the bidding of the West, whether it's America or whether it was Britain in the past. So that's what resistance means. It means resisting the occupier, which is America still today, militarily in some places, and in those places that they are not directly occupying, it is establishing popular governments that take the destiny of the people into their own hands.
Yeah, and let me come to you now, Kevin Barrett, and obviously some of the statements that I'm going to be asking both you and Samahdi Torabi to cross-reference it to present day and see how it applies, that would be greatly appreciated. For example, how Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei describing resistance, as Samahdi Torabi also said there, is the key for the Islamic world, where he said, to make up for the past when they were subject to arrogance, powers, interference. What is your take on that?
Well, it's, of course, the arrogant powers interference is ongoing, and it has not really decreased, despite the defeat of the U.S. in its attempts to occupy Iraq and Afghanistan. And, of course, when I said Iran by mistake, that's really what was the ultimate target with the 9/11 false flag operation and these 9/11 wars that followed. As we learned from General Clark, the neocons revealed to him shortly after 9/11 that the real purpose of all this is to take out 7 countries in 5 years. And he listed the countries. Of course, Iraq and Afghanistan were high on the list, but the real target, the ultimate target, was indeed the Islamic Republic of Iran, number 7 on the list. And by the will of God, of course, this is bogged down and it didn't succeed. But these arrogant powers are no less arrogant than ever, even though they should have been humbled, if not outright humiliated, by what's been going on over the past 20 years, as they have revealed themselves to be completely outside of this system of ideals that they say that they are run by, democracy and freedom and the heritage of the Enlightenment and all of this, says support for self-determination. It's all totally hollow. It rings hollow after what we've seen over the past 20 years. And then today, as what is left of freedom in the West is rapidly being crushed with this handful of oligarchs that runs the West, taking complete control over the internet and what's left of free speech, erasing the PressTV.com website, and these hundreds of thousands of stories that would have been found in search engines if the PressTV.com had not been erased, many of them telling the truth about what's been going on with the 9/11 false flag and these wars that followed. So the arrogant powers, rather than admitting their mistakes, and a good way to do that would have been for the Biden administration to apologize to Iran, come back into the JCPOA, but no, they're just as arrogant as ever. And so an arrogant power that no longer has the power that it once had might be doubly dangerous, like a cornered rat. And I think that The people of the Islamic Ummah need to realize that even though there's been an apparent victory in terms of holding off the U.S. in Afghanistan, and Iraq is recovering its own destiny as well, but they're not going to stop. They're not going to go quietly, and it could even get worse before it gets better.
Okay, Samahdi Torabi, when we have the topic of this program be the statements that Iran's leader has made on the occasion of Hajj, tell us how the statements that he makes can translate into actual either motivation or action when it comes to the respective, let's say, Muslims in the region. You talked about the Muslim people somewhere in your statements. Isn't there a disconnect when it comes to certain nations and its population and what their leading politicians are doing? I mean, many, for example, in Saudi Arabia are opposed to the way that or even UAE are opposed to the way that the normalization deal, the Abraham Accords, for example, has come in place. Can you tell us how the leader's statement can actually influence the Muslims' minds in that respect?
Sure. I mean, I think again, we have to look we have to take a longer historic and strategic view in order to understand this. And he himself, in the statement, referenced all this. He said that people can make the choice between resisting, and they've seen the example of Iran, and they've seen the example of Lebanon and Iraq and other places where people have resisted, and they can see the example of places like Saudi Arabia and the UAE where they haven't resisted, and not worse than that, they are doing the bidding of the U.S. in the region, and they are basically the tool with which the Americans try to control the region because they can't rule it directly as they used to in the past during the British era or during the 1 year that they after the invasion of Iraq. So it's far more than just, he's going to say something and people are going to get motivated. Of course, people are motivated. This is something that we did in Iran 2 years ago. The question always comes up, well, why did Iran have a revolution? Well, the reality is that, being independent is a value. Being independent is something that people want. And you can give them as much, material goods as you might see, for example, in some of these countries in the southern Persian Gulf, but it's all a golden cage. It's basically they're trying to keep them quiet, and they did that in Iran a long time ago. And why did the people rise up in Iran? Because they didn't have independence. They couldn't decide their own destiny. It was basically that Iran should be the policeman and the gendarme of the Americans in the region, and that's it, and sell them cheap oil and buy Western products and join the Western banking system and that's it. You do that, you'll have a good life. This is what they say to this day. They say if you just, not resist, and if you just follow us on issues like the right of the Palestinian people to live in their own country, things like the resistance against Israel, things like, having actually popularly elected or governments that are based on the votes and on the will of the people in these countries that are the closest allies of the U.S., well, don't talk about that, and we'll let you not die. You can eat, and we won't starve you with sanctions if you just, stop doing that. Well, that's obviously not what Iran is going to do, and that's what Iran hasn't been doing for 42 years. And, hey, let's compare Iran to a place like Egypt. Similar populations, a country that has a very long history of civilization, exactly like the Egyptians. The Egyptians have been trying to appease the Americans for 50 years after Camp David, and see where the Egyptians are and look at where the Iranians are today. I don't even have to mention the details. Everybody knows. You don't even have to talk about, technology or, the living standard or human development index or Gini or whatever other things that anybody wants to use as a measure of looking and comparing two countries that are very similar, like Iran and Egypt, and the result of resistance and the result of appeasement. So this is what it's about. It's a reminder. Imam started the issue of making the Muslims and the Ummah aware of things during Hajj and understanding that Hajj is not just some empty ritual where you go and you circle an old building and, you do some prayers. It's about Islamic unity. It's about showing, the reality of what it means to be a Muslim in terms of rule, in terms of, Islam is not just about personal worship. It's not about, how do I do personal prayer? It's about actually managing human society. It's about managing human civilization and having your own civilization. That's what Islam is. It's not really about personal worship, or you can't just reduce it to that thing, which is what, of course, the enemies of Islam want, is that we reduce Islam to this very banal, thing that has no value in terms of taking our destiny into our own hands. So this is what the message of the leader is to the Ummah.
And Kevin Barrett, maybe you can break this down a little bit for us in terms of the way that the U.S. is viewing the West Asia region, because obviously they have tried their military option with many countries in the region, in which the Iran's leaders stated some of those countries, such as Yemen, Iraq, Syria, and of course they'd like to get their hands on Iran. But the military option has not worked, after all these years. So and also we can talk about a little bit further down, going west to the longest military engagement that they had, and that was Afghanistan, which they are claiming that they're pulling out their forces and all that. So do you think the U.S. is reevaluating itself in the region? What is it doing? Where does it stand?
Well, I think some American policymakers recognize that the military option has not worked, and they're the ones who are partly responsible for keeping it from having been even worse and crazier, more destructive, and a bigger failure than it actually was. However, we should never underestimate the stupidity and evil of substantial segments of the elites that make U.S. policy, particularly the ones who are driven consciously or unconsciously by the Zionist, millenarian, messianic kind of fanaticism and paranoia that everybody in the world wants to drive the Jews into the sea and so on. Those kinds of people are willing to do outrageously irrational things and to adjust their perceptions so that they don't really see the obvious realities. But I think that the Americans are going to have to try something different at this point if they're going to shore up what remains of their empire in the region. And I certainly would expect that they would be reluctant to do any more of these out-and-out invasions with large numbers of U.S. troops that failed so abysmally in Iraq and Afghanistan. However, I wouldn't put it past them to try more surgical approaches to continue to inflict death and destruction on the region in more indirect ways and perhaps even deniable ways. We need to talk about the fact that COVID-19 appears to have been unleashed on the world by a neoconservative that is out of the U.S., a neoconservative biowar strike on Wuhan and Qom. And there's a very strong case for this, much of it a strong circumstantial case, but also a couple of real smoking guns proving that this is where it came from. I urge people to go to UNZ.com, that's UNZ.com, and read Ron Unz's magisterial work on this. And this is, of course, what the leader was saying back in March of 2020, that in fact we are under biological attack. And General Hossein Salami said, today the country is engaged in biological battle. We will prevail in this fight against the virus, which might be the product of an American biological attack, which first spread in China and then to the rest of the world. America should know that if it has done so, it will return to itself. And those words were indeed prophetic. We shouldn't put it past the people who came up with all of these bizarre futuristic war doctrines that they couldn't wait to try out in living laboratories and inflict death and destruction and bloodshed and suffering on people across the seas, to come up with new ways of doing that. So we really do have to be on our guard, even though the empire is clearly self-destructing, and it's mm-hmm. self-destructing because it doesn't have that moral and ethical and metaphysical intellectual foundation that the Islamic world does have. The Western world left its religious moorings a century or more ago and has now lost its ethical moorings, its intellectual moorings. It's lashing out and flailing. It's a dying beast, but it could still do a lot of harm as it dies. And so the Muslims of the world are in a position where we have preserved an authentic revelation that can provide the basis of a just and decent society where people can live in peace and pursue the highest goal of the human being, which is spiritual attainment. And we need to wake up to that. And the Hajj should remind us of this as Muslims from all over the world join together, that this is a good time to reflect on what progress we've made towards restoring Islam, not only as the basis of personal worship, as Dr. Tarabi said, but also as the basis of society. And that those are the kind of reflections that the Supreme Leader's speech should spur us to.
It seems, since we're quickly running out of time, that I need to bring this up and really get an idea from you, Sam Matthew Tarabi, if I can, when it comes to one of the issues that you don't see any really headway being made. I mean, honestly, and that is the issue of Palestine. You know, Iran's leader has, and Iran as a whole, has been behind Palestinians, behind that struggle. Why is it that, let me ask you this way. Do you think that Muslims have fallen short when it comes to the issue of Palestine, especially their leaders? Why is this still continuing, the occupation and, of course, the violation of Palestinians?
No, I don't completely agree with you. I think a lot of headway has been made. Again, it goes back to what the leader said in the speech, and I really urge everyone, you know, it doesn't matter what I'm saying or what everybody else is saying, read the speech. It's a short speech, and everything's in there. He talks about that, you know, we have two paths that are clear as moral lessons. This is what he said in the speech. He said one path, one lesson is the lesson of resistance, and one lesson is the lesson of appeasement and humiliation. So, yes, there are Muslims who have been fighting for Palestine with the Palestinians, and their example is clear. One of them is, one case is Iran, the Islamic Republic, and people like Haj Qasem Soleimani. And one example is, you know, these fake countries like the UAE and Bahrain, who, when you think about it, it's not the country that's actually making peace with Israel or with the Zionist entity. It's a family-run mafia that decides that it's in their favor now to do it. And, you know, nobody's going to ask the Emiratis. And by the way, how many Emiratis are there actually in the world? The majority of the people that live in the Emirates are actually not Emiratis. How many people live in Bahrain that are actually Bahrainis? That they haven't brought in order to change the population from Shia majority to Sunni majority. And the same goes for many other countries. So the answer to your question is, of course we've made headway. If you just look at what happened in the last war, again, he mentions it in the speech, that all the Palestinians, for the first time in decades, got together and resisted, whether they were the ones that are in the 48 territories, whether it's the ones that are in the West Bank and Gaza and in Quds, and even in the camps, in the refugee camps in the neighboring countries. So the fact is that this is a time where the lines are clearly drawn. And what we did in Iran is you need to take over the government of the country wherein the government is not popular. That's the strongest weapon you can have. They don't care about personal Islam. They get scared when Islam has a government. They get scared when Islam has an army. They get scared when Islam has an intelligence organization. They get scared when Islam has rockets and missiles and satellites and satellite TV stations. That's the Islam they hate,
okay.
And that's the Islam that scares them. So it's not just simply about doing this kind of I don't know what you would call it, some sort of a idealistic the slingshot Palestinian. It's actually about taking the instruments of power into our own hands. And as we mentioned, as Dr. Barrett mentioned, Islam is a software that allows us to manage civilizations.
Okay.
There was a time when we did this. There was a time when we forgot and were invaded and were occupied. And that time is over now. We are restarting Islamic civilization, and the place it started in is in Iran. And it's spreading to other places. That's what they hate, and that's what they're fighting. And that's what resistance means.
Okay, and I'm going to address the same question to you, Dr. Barrett, if you can, in closing, in a minute, if you can, please.
Yeah, well, that's a hard act to follow. It's beautifully said, Dr. Jarabi. I appreciate that. And it's exactly right. This is the rebirth of Islamic civilization out of its near ashes after the West had invaded and occupied and plundered it for centuries. And that we're at a stage now where we're seeing the progress as Islamic Iran has withstood these decades and decades of attempts by the West to try to crush the revolution. And the West may have contained the example temporarily by preventing other countries from following the path of Iran and establishing genuinely Islamic societies under an Islamic system, but they can't stop it forever. The people of the Islamic heartland are clearly ready to throw off their oppressors. In their hearts, the vast majority of people support the Palestinians, and that struggle is absolutely central, both symbolically, because it's all about religion, and it's also very important strategically. The moment that project ends, the settler colonial project leaves Palestine, that's when we know that we're there.
Thank you so much for that. Let me thank our guest, Director of the Risala Strategic Studies Institute, Sam Mahdi Torabi. Thank you for your comments. And author and Middle East expert Kevin Barrett there from Madison. Thank you. And with that, we come to an end of this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tafoe and the entire team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره، همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم امر الله سبحانه الا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
The universal persona of Imam Ali.